Welcome to episode 27 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department and now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. And our guest commentator today is DHS Assistant Secretary for Policy, David Heyman. I'll be introducing him shortly, but welcome, David.
Former Assistant Secretary.
Former, that's right. You've joined an elite club of two, right? And this room contains them all. There are no current Assistant Secretaries, and there is only two former Assistant Secretaries for Policy. So yes, it'll be a boring reunion for the rest of you, but we're going to have a good time. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe & Johnson to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. This week in NSA turns out to be surprisingly newsy, and remarkably the biggest news story is probably the one that didn't break. Glenn Greenwald has been threatening to disclose individual Americans who've been targeted for surveillance, and of course his narrative is they're all innocent Martin Luther King figures, and we should be shocked that they've been targeted. He said he was going to announce it last week and suddenly decided not to because the government went to him and said things that led him to think maybe disclosing these identities, at least as he had planned to, was not a good idea, presumably because the government has some active investigations of some of these folks, and some of them may turn out not to be quite the poster children for government abuse that Glenn Greenwald would like. So we're still waiting for that. I'm sure he will publish it. He's being abused from the left, which is entertaining for those of us who've watched him abuse everyone else from the left. And so I'm sure he's going to be highly motivated to produce a story, but he hasn't done it yet. The Washington Post seems to have a similar set of data about the kinds of targets the government has gathered information on, and they say they've done a several-month investigation into who's in the government's database, and claiming that 9 out of 10 of the account holders whose data is stored in some of these databases are not the targets. I had a post that said, well, gee whiz, if you're collecting emails, they're from the target to somebody else. That means that even if you only collected one email and stored it, half of all the account holders in the database would not be the target. And if you're like me and your email has hundreds, if not thousands, of people, any law enforcement, let alone NSA collection, would have probably 999 non-targets for every target. So I wasn't quite sure exactly what the point of the Washington Post article was.
I think there's an important point. This is Michael. And that is that the way this program has been sold and justified has been that it's narrowly targeted at non-U.S. persons abroad, and that any collection involving U.S. persons is purely incidental, terms which mean one thing in NSA speak and mean something entirely different in plain English. And I think what the article shows is that there's a whole lot of information about people who aren't targeted, and in particular about U.S. persons. And that's just, you know, to you and to me and to David, that's not news. But to the general public, I think that's something that they really did not know or did not appreciate.
Wouldn't you agree that the same is true for a government warrant that collects a year's worth of emails from one person? Everyone but that person who has been in correspondence with that person is a non-target account holder. But if you just add up all the account holders, it's going to be one target and thousands of people that they've been corresponding with. And so when you say that 9 out of 10 of the people who are represented in a database are non-targets, that's actually a surprisingly focused set of data.
I think there's a point there, but two responses. One of the big differences is, of course, that under 702, there's no judicial warrant authorizing the collection. It's all done on certification of the Attorney General and the DNI. And secondly, in the criminal context, there have actually been now a few courts that have said that sort of collection of whole email accounts violates the Fourth Amendment because it's not sufficiently particular as to what's seized. So,
aren't those the magistrates we've been making fun of for the last 6 months?
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting issue to play out in the criminal context. But on the FISA side, there is no judge that's approving these. There's just a judge approving the overall program and the fact that there is minimization procedures in place and targeting procedures. So I think there is that difference. And again, for me, the most troublesome thing is that there's just been a lack of forthcomingness, if that's a word, in terms of how the program has been described. And so I think what the Post article is about is just giving people a clearer picture of what's actually going on with 702. And interestingly, and maybe we're going to get to the PCLOB report, I think it gives a better picture than the PCLOB report, which just says, yeah, the program's great, it should be tuned a bit, but it's consistent with the statute and the Constitution, but doesn't give any flavor of how much information is actually collected about U.S. persons and about people who aren't targets.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that the Washington Post article focuses much on U.S. persons. It's much more trying to scare us with all the non-targets who are whose data is in there. But I certainly agree that the PCOG report is a long, largely exculpatory discussion of the 702 program. They don't find any legal problems with it. They don't find any surprises that it's functioning in a way that was not intended. They do have some fairly modest suggestions, and maybe not all of them so modest, for things that could be done to make the program even more privacy protective, which is, I suppose, what they have to do. They are, after all, the privacy guys, and if they don't suggest a few changes even to successful programs, then they probably don't think they're doing their job. Although I guess the same people who are attacking Glenn Greenwald from the left are also attacking the PCLOB for not having trashed the program, so they've had their one brief moment of fawning media coverage, and now they're just another government agency that's part of the conspiracy, as far as I can tell.
You know, what's interesting to me, and maybe I missed something, but two of the members of the PCLOB, David Medine and Patricia Wald, said that there should be a requirement for a FISA judge approval before the database can be searched for using selectors for U.S. persons. So people who weren't the targets of the collection, but the data about them is contained in the database, they said you should have to go to a FISA court judge. The two, I believe, Republican members said that, you know, they wouldn't go along with that. And no word on Jim Dempsey.
He recused himself, I think. He must have recused himself.
I looked for reference text. I thought that might have been the case, but I couldn't find it. But maybe that's...
Maybe he's not inclined to give the FISA court more authority. That's the other possibility. Yeah, that is interesting. Well, David is going to be our next guest, I believe. So we can ask him next Monday about the vote. And about his notion that the FISA court ought to be making more of these determinations. I think that's a heavy investment in a flawed institution myself. Why don't we save the details of the report, which we've more or less summarized. I think its news value is kind of over already. Since it didn't really trash the program, it's not going to get much coverage, but it will be interesting to hear David's take on it. Let's see, what else is happening in NSA? The Seventh Circuit has ruled on whether FISA intercepts can be reviewed by the target or by the lawyer for the target. And they said, no, you can't see this even if your lawyer has a security clearance. This is Judge Posner. Michael, did you look a little more closely at that decision?
I did. This is interesting because last year it was a big deal when a district court said that counsel for a defendant should have the right to see the evidence that was submitted in support of a FISA warrant application. And then the Seventh Circuit recently said, no, this shouldn't have gone to the defense counsel because under the statute, the defendant is entitled to review that sort of material only if adversary procedure is necessary to a fair consideration of whether the surveillance was lawful or not. And what happened here was that the district court said, yeah, I could read this stuff on my own and make a determination about whether it was lawful, but the adversarial process is sort of the foundation of American criminal law, and so I think it would be helpful to have defense counsel look at this and provide the defendant's perspective. And Judge Posner basically said, no, the judge has to review it and then determine whether review by the defendant is necessary to making that determination. And that's not what the district court did here. And then the Seventh Circuit went on to say, you know, we've reviewed it ourselves and we can make the determination on our own about whether the surveillance was lawful, so it doesn't need to go to defense counsel. I thought it was kind of amusing too that in writing this up, Judge Posner took a crack at the whole security clearance process and said, you know, there are far too many people with security clearances. There are far too many people with clearances who leak to the press and things like that. So that was clearly animating his view of this whole issue in the background, at least.
Yeah, that was his argument was just because you have a security clearance doesn't mean you're going to handle the information properly, and God knows that's true. I have to say, watching this story develop, it's disturbing just how faddish judicial doctrine is. Since this story broke, everybody's been talking about how there ought to be more adversarial process at the FISA court, and I think that whole notion is just infecting the judiciary. Because they read about it, they want to say, "Oh yeah, we should have adversarial process here," despite the classified nature of the data. And the other area where we're clearly seeing a fad for this, although I guess we can blame the Supreme Court for this one, is in Smith against Maryland, which suddenly everybody wants to talk about. And, you know, you go to Aspen and well-informed, laypersons want to talk about Smith against Maryland. I just came back from, Aspen, which is kind of a rich man's Cambridge, as far as I can tell, in terms of the unanimity of bien pensant opinion. And indeed, people did want to talk about Smith against Maryland. Let's close up on NSA. The ODNI issued its own transparency report revealing how many orders it served, how many accounts it was able to get information on. Kind of surprisingly, they served one order, or they got one order in 702 and got 89,000 accounts. I was sort of surprised there was only one order because they have two or three different bases for doing 702 intercepts, and this may reflect the decision not to use all the bases, or maybe they've dumped them all into a single order, which would be odd, but maybe what's happening. And then finally, there's an early favorite for a dumbest NSA story of the month. It too involves Bart Gellman and Ellen Nakashima, writing for the Washington Post, who wrote a long kind of jaw-dropped story about the possible foreign intelligence targets that the United States identified, that is to say, which governments, which countries might the government want to gather foreign intelligence on? And not surprisingly, the government, NSA, said, you know, it could be all of them except the ones that we have promised we won't gather intelligence on, which is four. So they had probably 190 countries on the list. The Post, you know, wanted us to be surprised or concerned or something about that. And I thought, geez, you know, if you're writing about the countries you might want to gather foreign intelligence, which ones are you going to leave out? Even Fiji has had military coups. So it's kind of hard to imagine a country where we wouldn't at least want to send in the Marines to rescue Americans from a violent insurgency or coup or some other breakdown in order, in which case they would want to gather intelligence on what the various sides are saying they want to do to the Americans who are guarding civilians. So it's kind of hard to see why we should be upset about that. And Ellen Nakashima in particular ought to know better than that, to treat that as a big deal.
Well, I just want to make a comment on that because one of the things I think was lost in the whole Snowden storyline is the types of intelligence we collect and why we collect it. There was a presumption, it seems, that the U.S. is looking into people's private affairs for perhaps, you know, using in malicious purposes or to leverage pressure in certain government affairs. But you make the exact right point, which is that there are U.S. citizens and U.S. interests all over the world. And at a very minimum, we should understand the stability of political systems and what's happening in those regimes where we may have to send in the Marines at some point because U.S. citizens are in jeopardy. And so there are different levels of intelligence that's collected, and people seem to lose sight of that.
Well, and there are, you know, it's hard to think of a country that hasn't produced terrorists and whose terrorists might at some point decide to strike at U.S. interests. We've produced plenty of our own, the Canadians, the British, the French, I mean, some of our best allies have a terrorism problem or a radicalization problem. And so again, it's just, well, as I said, it may be the dumbest NSA story of the month. Let's talk a little bit about Microsoft's fight with the U.S. government. This is the one where Michael wrote an amicus brief, and you got a little help last week, didn't you?
Yeah, not surprisingly, Vivian Redding, who's the vice president of the European Commission and in charge of justice and fundamental rights issue, wrote a letter to a member of the European Parliament basically saying that the decision by the magistrate in the Microsoft case was troubling because it puts companies that hold customer data from people in the EU into an impossible position, because if they turn information over directly to U.S. law enforcement in response to a search warrant served in the U.S., it could be violating EU law, and that accordingly, the U.S. law enforcement should have to go through cooperation channels with European law enforcement agencies in order to get that sort of data that's stored in the EU, which is, you know, precisely what Verizon, Microsoft, and other amici have argued in their briefs before the district court in the Southern District now.
Yeah, I saw that this was Sophie Intveld who asked the question, and she tweeted the answer. Do you know how you cite a tweet when you go to court?
You just provide the link to the website and say available at, and that's pretty much it. You could describe what it is, I guess, but these sorts of citations are so common now that they're no longer even surprising to see.
Yeah, the real problem is that at least 3/4 of them within a couple of years are gone and unfindable at that address. I know there are people working on finding solutions to that, but it's satisfying to cite it, but in fact, by the time somebody actually wants to go back and check your work, it probably won't be there. So, speaking of Vivian Redding, she's even more notorious for propounding the right to be forgotten as a kind of bumper sticker version of some of the data protection rules on correction of records, and something that was taken far too literally by the European Court of Justice. It now turns out that we know a little bit more about how Google is going to administer this right to be forgotten. They are not yet applying it to Google.com, though they are under increasing European pressure, because the Europeans won't be satisfied with their censorship regime until they've imposed it on America. We now know they are also responding, I think, to pressure from Europe, not going to tell us when they've left something out of search results on, say, google.co.uk. They'll just give us all a general warning that, in general, when you search on names, you shouldn't be completely surprised in European jurisdictions not to find everything that would otherwise be viewed as relevant. And they have started notifying what you could call the link owners, the content providers, the people who wrote the articles that are being censored, to let them know that they're being censored. And the first information there has surfaced in announcements by the BBC and The Guardian that they have been told that some of their content is being censored. The Guardian fought back, or bitched back, I think is probably the safer thing to say, and got Google to change its mind, as I understand it. So there seems to be a certain amount of jawboning, perhaps because the article that was censored, there was an immediate assumption that it had been censored because there was only one guy named in the article. Was former head of Merrill, who was blamed for various aspects of the financial crisis. It turns out that that probably wasn't his name that was being censored, but instead the name of somebody who had commented on the article and then regretted his comment. Evidently not realizing that nobody read his comment when he posted it and nobody's going to read it ever again. But maybe it shows up in his pitiful self-Googling exercises. And so as a result, it looks as though Google may have restored that in response to The Guardian's grumblings. But we don't know the name of the person whose comment triggered the takedown. It's been a good week for vindication for you, Michael. You also predicted, if I remember, that the New York cyberbullying law wasn't going to last long, and boy, it sure didn't. It was just, I guess it's not New York, it's a county law against cyberbullying, and it was extraordinarily broad, was challenged, went to the New York Court of Appeal, and bang, they just threw it out. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it really is breathtakingly broad, the way the county law was written. It basically established a criminal offense that included any act of communicating or causing a communication to be sent by mechanical or electronic means with no legitimate private, personal, or public purpose, with the intent to harass, annoy, threaten, abuse, taunt, intimidate, torment, humiliate, or otherwise inflict significant emotional harm on another person. So as long as it had to be private information. So if you send private information with no legitimate private, personal, or public purpose to another person with the intent to annoy that person, then you would be committing a criminal violation. And interestingly, person includes corporations or other organizations of people. And the court said this was just wildly overbroad. The ostensible purpose was to protect minors from bullying online, but obviously it's not limited to minors. It's not limited to online communications. And the Albany County, which is the body that passed the law, came in and said, well, okay, we recognize that this is really written too broadly, but can you sever all the other parts and just uphold its constitutionality as limited to sending, bullying messages online to minors of a sexual nature? And the court said that, you know, we do try to interpret statutes in a way that can preserve their constitutionality, but that would require basically gutting nearly the entire provision. And so they said they would refuse to do that sort of rewriting. And so
were the facts of the case such that it was bullying of a sexual nature?
It was. It was a 15-year-old high school student who created a Facebook page in which he posted photographs of his high school classmates and other kids with detailed descriptions of their alleged sexual practices, partners, predilections, and that sort of stuff, and with lots of vulgar captions. So it does seem like the sort of instance that the law was designed for, it's just that the law was written so overbroadly that there was just no possible way the court could uphold it.
So the court more or less then kind of hinted that it might have upheld it if it had been drafted a little more narrowly.
Yeah, it didn't really have much in the way of hints, because it essentially said we're not even going to go down that road because it would require so much rewriting of the statute. It wouldn't just entail, excising a few words or a couple of phrases here or there. It would basically have to rewrite it entirely and refuse to do that. There were two judges in the dissent, though, who would have narrowly interpreted it so as to uphold it. So there are two out of the seven judges who would have gone that way, but unclear if they could ever get a majority to uphold a more narrowly written law.
Well, and the last thing I wanted to cover before we turn to David Heyman is the SEC has finally stirred itself to actually investigate people for failure to disclose cyber intrusions. And I have to say, I think they've chosen the lamest possible, most predictable and useless target the SEC could have chosen. They've chosen target. Maybe there's something I'm not aware of, but Target did disclose that intrusion in what turns out to have been way too much detail when they didn't know enough to be sure, and that was probably part of their problem. But the idea that the SEC is going to start riding in the wake of the state attorneys general and the FTC and the plaintiffs bar to say, hey, us too, you might have violated some requirement of disclosing these things to your shareholders, strikes me as remarkably lame, given that there must be hundreds of intrusions by, say, the PLA stealing information from companies to give it to competitors in China of U.S. companies. And that's information that really could affect how the investors view the problem, view the company. So to instead kind of turn to this Me Too imitation investigation, which I guess was disclosed by Target itself, is sort of disappointing. We'll see. Maybe this is just one of many, but I'm hearing different things. There are lawyers who do this sort of thing who are saying, I don't think there's that many. And so it's not clear whether the SEC is doing anything useful here or just following along the leaders who have already brought these lawsuits. Michael, did you get a sense of whether there was anybody else that might be under investigation?
Not that I could see or find out. I would suspect there might be, but you know, this all does seem like a little bit of jumping on the bandwagon. And that's not to say the SEC doesn't have a legitimate role, but I think the fact that they started with Cargill, as you say, seems kind of lame, since there are lots of other companies that haven't yet been in the limelight, but that are equally at fault of having inadequate security and probably making inadequate disclosures. Even if you think Target might have made adequate disclosures, I'm sure there are many that haven't made any disclosures and should have.
Yeah. No, it's like that old saying, what did you do in the war, Daddy? Oh, I went out and shot the wounded on the battlefield. Not the most glorious career for a government investigator. All right, well, let's turn to somebody who has had a much more glorious career. David Heyman succeeded me and outlasted me as the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. Before that, he was the founding director of the Homeland Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he had worked in government before for the U.S. Secretary of Energy and the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and has also worked in the private sector. So he's got a long history and a distinguished one, and we're delighted to have him. So welcome.
Thank you, Stuart.
So, you know, this is, I'll try to keep this from being too down in the weeds, but why don't you talk a little bit about what the policy office does and what you were hoping to achieve in your 5 years there?
Sure, it's a little awkward telling you.
Well, you know, I should say I had a friend who actually was director of NSA, who he was an admiral, and he said once to me, he said, you know, I went to Annapolis with all these people. The guys in my class are extraordinarily able and bright and diverse and accomplished, and I meet them at reunions, and they all are doing great things. I really only run into two idiots: the guys who came before me and the guys who came after me.
Exactly.
Everybody now knows what we're thinking, really, as we're
right. Exactly. And in fairness, I do like to thank you at every opportunity for leaving behind some problems for me to work on. We have, I think there's different versions of what an Office of Policy can be. I'll talk about my version, and the version that I tried to implement over the last 5 years. The Office of Policy, at the Department of Homeland Security really served three purposes. One was to, advise the secretary and the leadership of the department and to provide decision analysis for some of the big challenges that we faced. Second was to do thought leadership, look over the horizon, some strategic thinking, and provide, you know, when it's an operational department, 98% of the department is working on a day-to-day basis in operations. The Office of Policy is really the only place, or one of the only places, that has a chance to look over the horizon and be forward thinking. So thought leadership second. And third, there's a coordination effort, not just on policy development, but within the interagency, representing the department's positions in the National Security Council meetings, that's in the SIT room, et cetera, but also coordinating international policy, where the department goes internationally, and some coordination within the private sector and our relation developing policy with the private sector.
Mm-hmm. And how did you do?
How'd I do?
pick a few topics that you really put an effort into.
Well, I mean, you know, I had the benefit of joining the department just at the point where its first instantiation of the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review was being developed. And
this is the QHSR. Right? And it's really a complete ripoff of the Quadrennial Defense Review.
Although in concept, but not in practice.
Yes.
I mean, it is a very different document, because Homeland Security is very different than military strategy and what the Defense Department does. But, you know, one of the things that was quite clear early on is that DHS, much like a lot of the other federal agencies, was a budget-driven organization. And the QHSR allowed us to take those first steps to making it a strategy-driven organization. So first and foremost was to set out a vision, to set out some enduring missions for the department, and in effect the Homeland Security strategy for the years 2010 to 2014. We've just completed the second quadrennial Homeland Security review, which just came out last week.
And the it's a tribute to the guys who did the first one. I kicked it off, but I didn't actually produce anything other than some meetings that turned out providentially with people like Rand Beers to get their input on it, which led them to think maybe there was something useful in it. But the second QHSR is more or less, in terms of the five big themes, the same as the first one.
So, yes. I mean, on the top level, and Secretary Johnson started just as we were getting the QHSR complete, the second one complete. So he had a chance to take, he rolled up his sleeves, took a look at it, and the department leadership was involved for the last year plus, year and a half. And one of the things is that the five missions, preventing terrorism, securing our borders, managing our immigration system, safeguarding cyberspace, and building national resilience. Those are enduring missions. And the vision of a safe, secure, and resilient homeland where American interests and aspirations can thrive is an enduring vision. Those two things are key for what goes afterwards.
Right.
What is the strategies within that? What are the goals and objectives? And then ultimately what you want to do is you want to turn strategy into resources. And
that of course is the really tricky transition.
That's the really tricky transition. And that's why I said, you know, one of the things I'm proud of is that, we did start in that direction, about a year ago, year and a half ago. We stood up a new way of taking, strategy and translating into resources through an integrated process that involved Undersecretary for Management, Science and Technology, the acquisition, all the folks who do acquisition. Secretary Johnson has picked that up and run quite directly on that.
Because he remembers that for him, the QDR is a well-established institution that, quite frankly, does more to drive resources than the QHSR.
And you often see at the end of a QDR major budget decisions, acquisitions or turning off of acquisitions. And the Department of Homeland Security will get there in the next 4 years because that's the path we started.
Well, and it's running out of money, so it's going to have to.
And that's the other thing is, so how do you do more with less? You know, the other thing that I think, the Office of Policy did over the last 5 years, which I think, there's the outbox, which is looking at strategy. There's the inbox too, which is taking a lot of hard problems and trying to find, you know, the least unpleasant solution to them. And we took a lot of hard problems and I think made some good headway on them. And these will be near and dear to you. 5 years ago, there were no real ID states that were in conformance. Now there's close to 30 that are on the pathway or in compliance.
And on a few that are moving backwards, right, that are, have gone back to issuing licenses to people who are not here illegally without necessarily including the legend.
There's obviously in California, there was a discussion about that. And there are discussions in a couple of states that are looking at that and obviously being, shaped by a very strong immigration national debate that's going on. Second is the overstays. How do you track, speaking of immigration? How do you track overstays? How do you have real time enforcement of overstays? That's a good question since the nation does not have an exit system comparable with what you see in, for example, Europe, where you're scanning a biometric on the way in or the way out. And we, in 2010, sort of changed the way we would do that. Instead of focusing tremendous amount of resources at the time, it was looking at billions of dollars, given the technology and the resources. Instead of taking all of those resources,
and fingerprinting everybody on the way out.
On the way out, and then having to change the way you do things on the way in, we would dramatically improve
the biographic exit system, which is using your passport and legal documents, such that it was virtually as good as a biometric system. And we have done that, and that's up and running. And you need that anyway to get a functioning exit system. You need a functioning exit system. All the linkages between all the different parts of the department, we helped sew together. And today you have, on a daily basis, real-time enforcement actions taking place on those who have overstayed, because the information of overstays is now going directly to the field for the ICE officers to enforce. So those are two examples of hard problems. I'll just give one third thing, which I think, Secretary Ridge and Secretary Chertoff both had the great challenge of standing up an organization. And both of them, I think, late in their tenures, really turned to focusing on the international dimensions of Homeland Security. And Secretary Ridge, to his credit, stood up a protocol office. Secretary Chertoff really established an international affairs office and put it in the Office of Policy. You got the chance to run with that. And I think under Secretary Napolitano, we really expanded that effort. And it's beneficial for manifold reasons. Most people think of Homeland Security as being just what's going on at home. But it turns out, you can do better security at home, and you can have greater impact and perhaps even with less resources the better your partnerships abroad.
Right.
And so we had a number of strategic partnerships we advanced continue to advance, including with multilateral organizations, which ICAO, ICAO, WCO, the World Customs Organization, and those organizations, those relationships endure. And I can tell you over the last 5 years, the ability for us to do our job at home has been greatly improved because of those
relationships. Well, we're going to face a big problem as ISIS establishes secure places where they can train and select from among the Westerners who have come there thinking they're going to fight Assad, and discovering that ISIS would rather send them back to blow things up in their home countries, or at least on planes.
So this is the Islamic
the
organization.
Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And now just as they've declared themselves recently, last week, I believe, the Islamic State.
Yes.
This is an offshoot of an affiliation of Al-Qaeda, who in some senses is trying to disown them.
They're too violent and too irresponsible.
This is exactly right. They've had a riff. Established itself in Syria, Western Iraq, and now has just spent the last 3 weeks approaching Baghdad and has established itself as a state.
So, thinking about that, we now have what is likely to be hundreds of Westerners who were radicalized either at home or when they got to the Middle East. How is it that our existing or the relationships that DHS has built up are likely to help us in responding to that kind of a threat?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm actually glad you brought it up, because it is and has been, in my view, the single greatest concern as it pertains to Homeland Security. And when Secretary Johnson started in December, these were some of the earliest briefings he took, because you now have not just ISIL or however you want to call them, but you have a number of ungoverned or weakly governed regions around the world where Al-Qaeda affiliates or those wannabes are establishing themselves. Libya is a good example, a mm-hmm. good but bad example of that. We've seen this over the years in Yemen. We see this great fight going on now in Nigeria with Boko Haram, Somalia, Al-Shabaab, Northern Africa. And so one of the things, if I just take a – I'll get back to your question. Just take a quick turn. In the second quadrennial homeownership review, this is probably the most important thing we said. And if you know how to read these documents, you'll see it's the first recommendation under the first strategic shift that we talk about, talks about the distributed threat that's now establishing itself in various places and building international partnerships and or reinforcing them is the number one recommendation that comes out of the second quadrennial homeland security review. And what do we mean by that? Historically, we have dealt with this terrorist threat and we deal with threats abroad through traditional national security considerations, which means what I mean by that is hard power, look, and to some extent some diplomacy. But we're looking at how do you solve the problem? Well, let's talk to the military. Let's talk to the intelligence community. It is clear to me after over a decade of Homeland Security and the department's existence and its work and working with the FBI and others, Michael's on the phone, that we need to establish not just Title 50 and, you know, Title 10 policies, but Title 6, 9, and 18, for those who don't know. Those are the border security, which means if we go to Libya, if we go to Yemen, and now, unfortunately, with Iraq, how do we establish better understanding of who and what is going across your borders? Mm-hmm. And how do you secure that so that you don't get a beachhead established, so that you don't have terrorists looking for weak or ungoverned spaces to
the idea is to have DHS provide some assistance in actually standing up a border force that will do the job.
DHS in collaboration with all the other agencies that play in that game. It's the Defense Department, it's the State Department. But DHS has the expertise. And in fact, we did a lot of that supporting the military in Iraq. One of the things that the department did is it established liaison officers abroad in Iraq was one of them.
Right. Yeah, that was the most expensive one we had.
Exactly, yes.
Because the State Department charged us an arm and a leg for all the security that the embassy provided.
Recalling your question also, that the European relationships that we have, critically important because you mentioned hundreds of concerns of Westerners going out there. It's actually thousands if you consider all the Europeans mm-hmm. who have gone to Syria for training or operations or whatever they think they're going to get out of fighting over there. And the Europeans have a bigger problem than the United States does right now because, number one, they've got more folks who are going there and coming back. And number two, even those who are going there perhaps to go to the United States fly through Europe,
right,
which is a general practice.
Right. And half the people on the plane are going to be Europeans.
Right.
So that raises a question that and maybe it provides the answer. I've noticed that we've had a terrible year in relations with Europe, as bad as when I was there.
I would say it's never been as bad since the time you left.
and yet, despite all of the things that the European Parliament wants to do, the European Commission wants to do, very few people in Europe seem to be calling for reconsideration of the PNR deal, which allows us to collect information on every European and every American who flies into the country. And I wondered whether what has changed, and it has to be something about the European conception of Europe's self-interest, but do you have any speculation on why they would threaten the safe harbor, the SWIFT deal, and take PNR off the table?
I like to think it's because we wrote such a good agreement
they just don't want to see you again,
or you. I think people have to remember that there's kind of three Europes. I mean, when people talk about Europe, there's maybe even four, but in terms of who speaks for Europe, you have the member states, you have the European Commission, and then you have the European Parliament. And, post Snowden, the European, all three of those were kind of in sync in terms of speaking for Europe and being outraged and feeling that there's been a trust that has been broken. More recently, because the member states have had long-standing relationships and bilateral discussions with the administration, that leaves the parliament as who incidentally was just up for re-election,
right,
or is up for re-election in some cases. And so the politics of privacy and renegotiating things with the United States are somewhat driven by the parliament. And in terms of PNR, we just had our reunion. It was a reunion of sorts. We had our review. There's an annual review or semi-annual review, which went very well. And I think, one, the European Commission in particular, and even the parliamentarians who worked on this have been impressed with what we said we would do and what we did. And number two, frankly, there's a lot of member states that want PNR systems.
Right.
And they've agreed to have PNR systems in Europe. The rest of the world is going in that direction.
So they may feel it's hopeless to fight it now. It's going to happen. And they've got a constituency that, given what's happening in Syria and Iraq,
exactly,
really wants to have these tools.
They need these tools.
Right. So yeah. it is no longer popular to trash it as some bizarre.
It's hard to have somebody arguing against a tool that can be quite helpful. At the same time, your front lines are about thousands of people going to Syria, coming back, and possibly threatening your population.
Well, good. It only took 10 years for them to figure this out, but maybe they are finally figuring it out. Though I'm sure there are plenty of people who will revert to it because they just can't stay away from it. Let me ask you before we finish up about something that I felt the policy office, well, held the whole department was just beginning to figure out what to do with, which is cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. Aspirational when we put it into the QHSR that the department had a lot of statutory authority and very little practical to offer companies on cybersecurity or the rest of the government. And usually that means you're going to get your lunch eaten. And in many ways, the department did. My sense is the department's done quite a bit more, but you were closer to it. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of what has been done well and what remains for the department to do?
It is the newest mission for the department. It was established under QHSR 2010. And for, just an inside story, it was barely established in the sense it wasn't in until the very final deliberations.
Huh. Yeah.
But it went in and I think to, particularly Secretary Lute's credit, who ran with it, but Secretary Politano for recognizing this and leading. We had there was a lot of arbitration that needed to take place in terms of what is the department's equities, what are the assignment of roles within the federal government, and there was a lot of that going back and forth over the first couple of years. That said, I think that's old history now, and where the department is really standing up the capability for protecting .gov, the continuous monitoring procurements that are going forward. I think not only will are extremely helpful, but
and this, broadly speaking, correct me CDM. If I'm wrong, is an effort to do for the civilian side of the government what is already being done by DOD on the Pentagon side, which is monitoring what comes in.
It's called continuous diagnostics and monitoring, yeah. And it's before things get into your behind the wall, you actually have a sense to find out if there's something that you're concerned about coming in.
So watching for malware, watching for viruses, watching for particular correspondents who have already been identified as bad guys or IP addresses that are bad.
Yeah, it's mainly looking for signatures of attack.
Right.
And this would be for the civilian infrastructure in the federal government. That's going ahead. That wasn't going ahead several years ago.
Right. That's expensive.
It's extremely expensive.
It takes a lot of smart people just to run it. Right?
Exactly. one of the things that the folks don't appreciate, I think, though, is, and if you haven't, Stuart, if you haven't had a chance to take a look, is the NKIC, which I think is going to be one of, if not already, the crown jewel of one of our cyber infrastructure in the federal government. The NKIC is a newly established incident response and a situation awareness team at the Department of Homeland Security, working in direct partnership with states, with the private sector, and the rest of the federal family. And it has, you know, real-time domain awareness and the ability to respond to incidents, and has been extremely effective behind the scenes, working both with the private sector but also with state and local governments and the federal family. So there's a number of things that, you know, you can see, but this is all the very beginning, and I think you're still going to have fights about the assignment of roles and responsibilities.
But if you have those fights when you don't have enough competent people to do the jobs that you think you should be
right.
doing. And once you have competent people running the NKIC, running the protection of .gov, you've got competent people who also can, you know, sit around a table and say, this is a good idea, this is a stupid idea, and this is worth thinking about, something that nobody can do if they haven't actually done the work.
Right.
And so increasingly we're going to see intelligent policy options coming out of DHS already having been sort of chewed over by people with technical capability.
Yes, and in fact, to your point about where the Office of Policy lies in that, I did spend a number of years trying to establish under the Undersecretary of Policy, which is the equivalent of what you and I served under, an assistant secretary. There are five assistant secretaries mm-hmm. that work in the Office of Policy, and I tried to establish one for cyber, but for various reasons was not successful. I do believe you'll see that coming forward, going forward.
It makes all the sense in the world given how important it is. And, you know, I understand that the office responsible for this probably thinks, you know, we might not need so much help from somebody else.
Well, this is the way most offices feel within the department and why it's a great challenge for the leadership in the Office of Policy to do their job. And to work as a teammate to help all of the department.
So let me just close on TSA. TSA has had a lot of changes, most of them to the good, I think, although there are certainly new risks that they're taking. And now they apparently face a much tougher climate, both a more aggressive set of terrorists who are coming up with new ways to develop bombs, hide bombs, and increasingly a judiciary that is skeptical about things like the no-fly list and the mechanisms for getting off it. Where do you think TSA goes in light of all of those kind of cross-cutting risks and concerns? And I guess I would add to that, are we finally past the point where people are hating TSA and they've moved on to hating BLM or NSA or some other three-letter agency?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. First of all, hats off to John Pistole. I think he's done a very good job managing one of the most difficult parts of the department to manage. It is the front line. It is in the public, most interaction with the public. And so every day, you know, you're either getting somebody who's not happy or is making their own blog on TSA. But they have, and under his leadership, they have shifted really dramatically towards risk-based security, which is where pre-check comes in, and managed inclusion and all of these things that allow for TSA to focus really on the most egregious concerns, and not on, you know, not assuming, as perhaps might have been the case a long time ago, that everyone's a terrorist who's going
right.
through there. And so the risk-based security program and the pre-check, I think, is the hallmark of the future, and we need to continue to go there. But you bring up the case that was just came out last week, where I think not wasn't a criticism about TSA or about no-fly lists. It's about redress, and when people are on it, how do you get off of it?
Mm-hmm.
And the judge was very critical of the program. I did not read all of the material. I know the case was filed in 2010, and I know there's been a tremendous amount of work since then to improve the redress program. In particular, to have the government review who's on the list and take them off on their own accounts for various mm-hmm. reasons. So I think you're going to continue to see that evolve and improve over time. I think that's a good thing. And I think you'll see TSA continue to move in the risk-based security functions that they've already established, and hopefully see them be a bright and shining shore of the department in the future.
All right. Well, before we close, we always ask our guests if they have anything they want to promote. So are you writing a book? Are you giving speeches? What are you going to be doing in the future that our listeners ought to be aware of?
So I will promote a very good transition from the public sector to the private sector to include summer with family.
Excellent. And, you went to Glacier.
I went to Glacier National Park, drove out across the country, took a week to drive out there, and then spent a week with some family and friends who, as you know, with these jobs, you don't see so much during the time you're in them. And so, I got two little ones, going to spend the summer with them, and then this fall you'll hear some news about me going into the private sector.
So your little ones have never known a time when you weren't in government, right?
No, in fact, my 3-year old yesterday we drove past the Department of Homeland Security and he said, "Dada's office."
Yeah.
He will always think that's Dada's office, and I tried to disavow him of that, and he was like, "No."
Well, that's Daddy's office. Yeah, yeah, that's there are worse things than that.
It's right.
Well, okay. Michael, do you have anything any speeches coming up? And frankly, neither do I, as far as I know.
I may see you in Aspen. Is that?
Oh yes, I am going
to. I will be in Aspen.
I was just out in Aspen. I gave my speech. Did you hear that?
I heard your opening remarks on the show about how much you liked it.
Yes. they're very sweet people, right? But you do get a sense that there's a surprising unanimity of view, right? And it turns out that not all of the United States has to be flown over on the way from New York to California. There are a few places you can stop and refuel and find people just like the people you see in California and New York.
Yeah.
And Aspen turns out to be one of them. But they were very sweet, and they were very polite when I declared that privacy was just a moral panic and we should just get over it. And I think that's until I go out to Aspen for the Homeland Security stuff.
I'll be going out there, for Homeland Security, end of July, and I am working on writing and, taking your advice, but I'm not going to go skating, as it were.
Okay. Well, my advice is, you always write something, because if you don't write something, one, you never do the research you should have done before you made the decision. And two, you forget it all becomes this big blob of something.
Right.
But if you go back and kind of say, what were the most important lessons that I want to convey to the world? You also retain it for yourself.
And Stuart did that at the Center for Strategic and National Studies, I was working at the time.
And you were an inspiration to me, and I hope I inspired you to go to DHS.
Thank you.
So this has been episode 27 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas and David Heyman. We hope you'll join us next week when David Medin, the chairman of the P Club, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, will be joining us, and we will once again be providing insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.